Okay. All right, so there's a lot of buzzwords in this lecture because this is a field that, by its very nature, encourages a lot of what I would call retronyms. A retronym is a word that gets invented to contrast with an existing word that if the other word didn't exist, you wouldn't need. So we have words like brick and mortar, which only we need to have because we invented the sort of online alternative to brick and mortar. And we make a big deal about offline and online, and because offline used to be just everything. And now we have online, so we have to talk about offline, things like that. A channel essentially is any means by which a supplier of goods or services provides it to the customers, or any customer contact point at which interactions can occur. We want to rule out sort of one way, like just broadcast, because that's, while it does contribute to value, we don't tend to think of that as a design in the same kind of consideration as we have when we worry about integration across channels. So, I'm not quite sure where that goes, but I'm not sure it doesn't go in this lecture. Yes? A channel is a kind of a class of touch points, maybe within some technology medium or physical or technology medium or something. I'm not getting it. Again, it's a funny word because I'm going to talk about some traditional marketing things like channel conflict, which is a very abstract thing, but it could also have very physical implementations, issues. We tend to contrast in the service design literature, person-to-person, and self-service as channels. That was why I started this semester, saying those are the primary contrasts in the multi-channel service system. I'm not so sure anymore after reading the lecture notes again 3 or 4 times and reworking them, because there's a lot more nuance than I think I conveyed at the beginning of this semester. There's a lot of people now writing about the contrast between virtual and physical channels, where virtual, again, is a very broad kind of thing, meaning something which is not physical, but it could be a lot of different kinds of technologies. From a technology standpoint, we can see the evolution of channels. The first multi-channels, I think, were mail-order catalogs. You know, we get these catalogs every Christmas season. We get inundated with things from people. Those, in some sense, is kind of like trying to bring the store to the customer, rather than having the customer go to the store. So it's trying to get another channel to interact with. And the original way that worked was you send a catalog to a customer, they send you a mail back, and then they send the product would come back in the mail. We started having the ability to call on the telephone to order from that catalog about 1960. And then we started having ATMs, physical device outside of a bank to get money other than the bank hours. That's about 35 or 40 years ago. We invented the touch tone pad on a telephone, where instead of having the rotary dial you might have seen in museums or something, not in your house probably, that touch tone gave us the ability to use the telephone as kind of a transactional device. We could now do push 1 for this and push 2 for this. We then got it smart enough to do a little bit of voice recognition to have another kind of channel on the phone. Of course, we could still talk to people on the telephone. Today, I think the most ubiquitous channel, a virtual channel, is the PC, or the personal computer on a web browser, whether it's your PC or Mac, whatever. I mean, personal computer in a generic sense. And people are starting to say that the mobile device will likely replace that. I'm not convinced, especially in situations where we have what you might call government services, where you have digital divide considerations, where you don't want to say, you don't have a cell phone, you can't get services. So you're old, you're disabled, you may not be able to use a cell phone for service. That doesn't mean we shouldn't serve you. So there may be limits on the emergence of the mobile platform as a channel because of that, those kind of considerations. But no question that mobile services are picking up as the device gets smarter. How many of you have ever seen a Sears catalog? The Sears catalog was invented in 1887 when the Sears company thought it could make a business out of sending people a catalog with all these goods you could buy, especially if you lived far from a city. The Sears catalog preceded the store by almost 40 years. There wasn't a Sears store until 1925. The catalog was there before there was a store. So in some sense, the second channel was the physical store. What's interesting about this is that you could buy almost anything. You could buy a house in the Sears catalog. There are over 75,000 houses in this country that were built with kits. You order them. They came in 30,000 pieces, including the paint and the nails, and a 100-page instruction manual for your carpenter. It came in a big box on a train, and they sent it to your town, and then you would build the house that you bought in a mail-order catalog. It's fascinating. There's still 5,000 of these houses standing in this country. And they go for huge amounts of money because they're so retro. The mail order house. Look it up. There's more contemporary examples of multi-channel service systems. We see stores with both a physical and a web presence. We see the kiosk, the terminals inside of stores, so you can say, go look up the inventory and maybe order this out of stock in the store, but you order it online. Some of you may have done that at places like bookstores. You have firms that are now using downloadable coupons or RSS or Twitter feeds saying, go do this for this promotion, making special offers to customers. You have a lot of this kind of inventory integration where you can say, I go to the online site to see what's available in the local store, so I can buy online and pick it up at the local store. Or I can do the reverse, which is take something I bought online and return it to the local store if I don't like it. Requires integration of inventory systems. We clearly have banks with lots of different interfaces. And we have government offices that try to provide online equivalents. This is a picture of Home Depot taken about 6 in the morning when there wasn't anybody there. Because usually it's pretty busy early in the morning when the contractors get there to do their work. But there's also Home Depot online. Any of you who've ever gone to the DMV, the motor vehicle place, would know how much better it would be to go to an online version. Because the physical version is really, really bad. Now, you seem to be skeptical, Michael, is that right? You've been to the online DMV? Compared to the physical DMV?
It's even worse?
I got to hear this. I spent an hour and a half getting my license renewed in the physical. I thought it was the worst experience of my life.
No, it's actually a better experience, but they publish things which are not accurate. They publish checklists, and they're not complete. You bring everything into the physical DMV. You come with a file. They say, oh, you're missing your I-20 form.
Okay, so I should change this title to from better than to still as crappy as the physical DMV. Okay, could someone send me a note to that effect so I can change my slides? All right. Gee, I thought it was better because it couldn't have been as worse as the physical one. All right. I have a bank called Wells Fargo which has this enormous number of channels. It has the physical branch. It has the ATM. It has the telephone. I can talk to a person. I can do touch-tone interaction. I can do mail checks to get deposited. I can go to the web. I can go to my cell phone. All Wells Fargo. They've done a really wonderful job with this multi-channel integration. I have one account, and it works all those places. It's the same data about how much money I got. What an amazing thing. So there clearly are lots of applications of multi-channel service systems. One that I hadn't thought of until this weekend is the notion of distribution channels, which is a new kind of, not a new idea, but it's a new way to think about multi-channel systems, in that there's a question of, If you are selling a product or service, do you sell it directly to your customers or through an intermediary, through a middleman, pardon the sexism, a middle person, intermediary, okay? And think about it. Some things are always sold that way, always sold through distributors and resellers, and some things are almost never sold that way. So how do we decide? What factors do we consider when we say, do we sell this to our customers directly, or we sell it through somebody in the middle? What do we sell directly to customers? What kind of things?
It could be anything. It just depends on the company.
Well, would you buy food directly from the provider?
Well,
you could. You go to the farmer's market, but you most likely go to the supermarket where there's an intermediary, right? Do you buy clothes from people who make them? Do you buy cars directly from the factory? Do you buy haircuts from the people who create them? newspaper? You go to the website of the newspaper, or do you go buy it from the person who throws it at the, or at the box where you buy it at the front of the coffee shop? So some things are sold direct, some things are indirect, some things are sold both ways. Furniture store? You go to a cheap store, you buy things, you pick it up and take it home. You go to a fancy store, they go, we will make this Italian soap in 73 weeks. And you're lucky you'll get it in 73 weeks. Because the fabric has to be hand-sewn by the linen guys in Milan. And you go, give me a break. All right? Everything is custom-built to order by somebody else. The store is just a front. Okay? Services, are they ever sold indirect? More than you might think. If I can now go to any number of like tax preparers, and the forms actually get sent to India or someplace to get done by an accountant in India. So I have an office that's basically just a drop shop for my taxes. In Berkeley, dry cleaning is done indirect. You go to the dry cleaner, they probably don't do your dry cleaning on premises because Berkeley doesn't want to have chemicals. It's bad for the environment. Now, it's not bad for Fremont's environment. So they take them and they drop them to Fremont. They do one big factory in Fremont. But the actual front stage is just a drop shop where your clothes get picked up and then taken someplace else to be done. So the service of dry cleaning is an indirect service in Berkeley. So this it depends, okay? And it depends on the complexity of the process. You need an agent to help you choose or to install or make good use of this thing. So when you buy a house, do you buy it directly from the seller? No, you have an intermediary, the real estate agent. But if you have a smart service, like a Zillow or somebody else, maybe you can disintermediate some of the agents. So, really important question. And it gets at some interesting questions about channel conflict, which we'll talk about in a minute. Now, why do you want to experience things directly in the direct channel? Because sometimes you have to. There's a very interesting contrast in the Neslin paper about experienced goods and information goods. Remember that contrast? Anybody remember reading that paper? What's an information good? Okay, I'll help you out. Do you have to, if you can learn everything you need to know about the product without having to touch, experience it, then it's primarily information. I could say, I want to buy this book. I need to know its ISBN number or its title or its author. I'm assuming that all the books are the same. I'm not caring about the particular physical copy, what it looks like, what it feels like. But if I want to buy clothes, I may want to go to the store and try them on or look at them or feel the fabric. Okay? So first-time purchases are almost often experiential for things like clothes. I mean, you can always buy a replacement shirt. If you got the one you bought, then buy it online. But the first one you want to probably buy face-to-face. You have this ability to have more fidelity in the experience. Of course, you can also more readily negotiate prices and terms and conditions if you're face-to-face with somebody. You can say, you can't really haggle as well online as you can in a face-to-face encounter. This is probably really still the way to put it, but I said, service providers have potential for real-time dynamic adjustments. Meaning, they can look at you and say, should I charge more for this? How flexible should I be in my negotiation? Maybe I should speak slower with smaller words. This person doesn't strike me as being very smart. But they're speaking language that they don't, I'm not, they're speaking Spanish, and they're speaking hard to understand English. Maybe I should change the way I talk to them in order to, make a better provision of my service. It's hard to do that online, to do this real-time adjustments. Think about a restaurant. Okay? A good waiter is excellent at this. A bad waiter is bad at this. Okay? Think about the difference in the service you get in a restaurant. Because a good waiter can make real-time dynamic adjustments of the offering. Okay? Change, you know, they can suggest things to you that are you won't get it if you're going online, for example. So this is why we have, you know, commission salesmen. Some people are really good at making deals. Some people are not so good at making deals. They're really good at sort of sizing up the customer and dynamically changing the offer to close a deal. Some of this may remind you of this slide. Okay? What kind of things can you sort of, if a service has physical components, interpersonal components, and information components, you know, whether you sell direct or indirect may depending on the mix of those things. Which is the most important dimension of the product or service? Is it the information part or is it the experience part? Likewise, I might remind you of this slide. We talked about these 25 different possibilities of how you mix production, distribution, and consumption. I decided now that we're getting toward the end of the semester, I should have flashbacks to remind you that you did things early in the semester which are still relevant 12 weeks later. Okay? This chart showed us that something like teaching could be done where production, distribution, and consumption are together in space and time. You kind of opposite them. We talk about things that's happening right then and there in one place, the same place. Or I could go here and record my lecture, post it online, you then download it in the privacy of your own home at some other time. So production, distribution, and consumption have been separated in space and time. Again, whether how that happens will depend a bit about the kind of thing it is. So again, we have an abstract understanding of what the service is about. Just help you understand how you can go direct or indirect. So here is the classic kind of picture of a supply chain for some kind of, let's say, product or service. And in the middle, that the black dot is the enterprise that sort of is the provider in some sense. Now, what they're doing may be based on other kind of components or backstage kind of things that are not visible except to them. Okay, and then the customers here may interact directly with that provider or interact through some set of intermediaries who might be the store. So I don't buy from GM or Procter & Gamble. I buy from the local car dealer or the local Walmart. They're the retailers and distributors in that chain. And you can, of course, the nature of the goods or the nature of the service will affect how many levels there are in this, or tiers there are in this picture. How many pieces or how many levels of pieces have to get put together to assemble this offering. Now, in a direct channel system, the customers get it directly from the provider. And see all those happy faces there. They're just getting right from the provider. And that works just fine. And in fact, if you think about, that's the farmer's market. We don't have to put things through safe. We get them directly from the farmer. And that's part of the value proposition of the food, in that it's direct from the farmer. You know, farm fresh. You get to talk to the guy that picked the corn that morning. As opposed to going through some impersonal supply chain that drove up behind Safeway in the middle of the night and dumped up the goods and the alienated workers put them on the shelves. Okay? A website where you sell things directly to your customers could be this. But having a website does not make you a direct distributor. Because Amazon sells on the web, but Amazon is selling things that it didn't make. So Amazon is a distributor for somebody else. Amazon is one of the people out here on the distribution side, not the manufacturer of the books and things it sells. Now, it's tempting, of course, to try to do both. And so think about you as a customer. When you obtain a product or service, you probably care a lot about the price, maybe the quality of service, but do you care about who did it? Do you care who made it? You may not. You say, as long as this thing comes and it's what I wanted, do I care whether I got it from direct from the manufacturer, whether it was I bought it at a store? May not matter that much to you, okay? But to the provider, there's a dilemma, because the provider can presumably provide it cheaper to you if they don't go through a channel. If I have to put things through stores, I have to pay them some part of my profit. It goes to them in order to do the distribution. Okay? But if I do that, I do that to expand my reach. I can now sell to more people because I have more store outlets. But I no longer have direct contact with my customers. Which means I may not have the ability to learn from them, and I may not be able to match their expectations as well as if I was talking to them directly. So customers, they get upset because something was wrong with the product or service, but you didn't provide it directly to somebody in the middle who might have caused those problems. So you're tempted to do both. But if you try to do both, namely sell directly to some customers so you can have close contact and a lot of information with them and maybe have better prices for them, as well as sell through the channel, then there's a problem, because these people will say, this isn't fair. Because you're selling people at a price here that I can't match, because this, of course, my profit's got to be built into there. So you can undercut me on price. Why should I bother carrying goods if you're going to undercut me on price? So this very delicate balance about where you sell. In fact, it's less important whether you sell direct or indirect than whether you get data about your customers. So in some sense, what really matters is, do you know who has your stuff and how they're using it? That's more important than, did you actually sell it to them directly? And that's why you may remember this flashback. I forgot to write down the flashback date. There's a flashback from a paper called called Turning Shoppers into Advocates. The day we had, I think, the survey of all the different kind of services in early September, which talked about how important it was to track, not just collect the data, but to actually analyze it and use it about your customers. It says, collecting data is step one, step two is mining it, step third is operationalizing the insights. So you want to get the data, but you have to use it. And so being direct, if you don't use the data, it's not important. Being indirect, if you get the data and use it, is what you want to do. So that's what's important. Okay. Well, why do we want to do this stuff? Well, clearly, if you're selling through multiple channels, you have a website as well as a physical storefront, you can reach customers all over the world, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Your customers could buy from you in their underwear in the middle of the night. That's good for the customers. You can offer a lot more stuff. Why is that? Why can you offer more stuff in an online store than a physical store?
There's no space constraint.
You don't have to have the space to put the stuff. Why else? Your market is much larger, so you can presumably offer more stuff, thinking you could sell more stuff. Something very, very important, though.
It's all distributed.
It's distributed. You don't even have to own it. You're selling stuff that you don't own. You could say, I have a relationship with distributors. When I take the order, I have them ship it. So remember drop shipment? So I can have a gigantic inventory that I don't have to even own. So that's really important. A really big idea of having an online channel is I can track people better. It's pretty obtrusive to follow people around a physical store. In fact, don't you hate when the service person says, "Can I help you?" And you go, "Get out of my face. I'm just browsing, thank you." Right? But of course, they can track you every little moment of your online experience. They know how long you looked at every page, every item, everything. Which gives us the ability, if done right, to dynamically personalize the experience, both in terms of the content, the interaction structure. I can change the prices to give you a promotion in the middle of your browsing experience. Like I mentioned, you should go look at the patents there about all the clever things that Amazon does to improve their ability to close a customer by very cleverly tweaking the offering based on your browsing history through the catalog. So you never buy things the first time through Amazon. You might get a better deal if you come back several times. Those are all good things. Okay? The problem is, this is what I really liked about the Neslin article. It had a very nice picture. This one. Does anyone remember this picture? Did any of you read this article? Okay. What does this article say, Nate? What does this picture say?
So this is the
Right. A very sad thing happened to a lot of companies 10 years ago or 15 years ago as the web started coming on, was they said, "I had this wonderful small business and I sell very well in my small town. I'm going to have a website and start selling my stuff all over the world and I'll become a gigantic store and I'll be rich and everything else." So you publish your catalog with your stuff in it, and next thing you know is nobody ever comes to your store again because they realize you have uncompetitive prices. Because now your customers can compare your price with other people's prices at their website and said, "If I drive 5 more miles, I can get a better price. If I order online, I can get a better price." So the many business models depended in the old economy before there was the web on, should we say, customer ignorance. Okay? Customers had bad information about price and quality of service because you had your local stores. You put up a website, people can compare you, it's like, wow, I should drive to the other town and buy stuff or buy it online. Because it exposed their uncompetitive offers. You became this kind of, You know, at best, you added, they don't, and you have this problem of you have a bigger market that which you can't compete in. So you lose. Now, what's a good example of this, who did this? People used to be very much local distributors of pretty expensive products. Then let's sell these things online. And an awful lot of them got hurt real bad by that. Because the online people could have more volume. Well, if they could do it well, they could basically outdo the local guys. Well, video is a pretty good example, right? You see a lot of video stores these days around in our neighborhoods? Right? How about car dealers? Okay? Car dealers go, great, we'll put our website. People, well, what price do I get?
Tell me we'll talk about it. No, what price do I get? Well, here's our secret web price. Like in the old days, you could say, 1999, 2000, you go to the deal and they give you the web price. Don't show it to anybody else, because it's better than when we give it to you if you come into the store. And then you go, and they go, oh, shit, that's $1,000 less than I would have got if I sold it here in the store. So trying to get a bigger market, more exposure, really hurt them. So a lot of people try to do these things where they say, well, we only want to give you product information and not give you price information, and going, yeah, right. So this is a real dilemma for me because it's the downside of trying to have this broader multi-channel reach. Now, if you look at this, most of that's good for this perspective of the customer. The customer's great. I could have time and location independence, 7x24. I get this long tail selection. I get much more search and information about things. I compare things. These tend to be things which are good for customers, but bad for providers to a certain extent. Especially the last one, because now I can compare things and say, that local store is not very competitive. So there's a lot of these going out of business sales at the local, you know, DVD rental place. I mean, are there any other stores left? Does anyone have a local DVD store they go to? Or do you use Netflix? Who uses the local DVD store? Bless you. Is it like your cousin's store or something?
This is a store that I go to when I go back home to my parents' house. It's a store that has the kind of like what Netflix became famous for, the independent foreign movies.
Okay.
So it's carved out a niche on its own. It, of course, has the Hollywood blockbusters, and then it sells the neighborhood vibe. We're not the big guys, and for some reason it seems like it's selling well.
Well, that's a rare, that's the kind of example that proves the rule, I think. Jackson?
I canceled the Netflix and started using the 99 cent DVD kiosk.
Oh, the red box. Wow, that's a hardcore 99 cent deal, isn't it? I mean, that's if you only do like a couple movies a month, that's a much better deal than Netflix, isn't it? And Susan doesn't have enough time to watch 10 movies a month, so you might as well go to the red box. Well, again, people prefer different channels. They have preferences. What a good segue. You may have different values. Sunny wants to help her neighborhood store because their family store for her whole life has gone to that store. They know her by name, don't they? Welcome home, Sunny. How's school, right? No? Then why do you go there? So this is the bleeding heart Sunday talk, and I want to help these people. They're not competitive. They're going to go out of business eventually. I want to keep them alive one more semester. All right, good for you. But again, channels may be perceived differently on the basis of security, privacy, trust, reliability. There was a time when people wouldn't shop online. They thought you'd always lose your credit cards online because the bad guys would steal them. They could steal them a lot better ways than that. One at a time is not the efficient way to steal credit cards, I tell you.
The preferences are not absolute. They depend on services. You'll see in a minute how preferences for different aspects of an overall service system like banking will differ tremendously in different channels for different people. An important question is, who gets to choose which channel you use? Is it your choice, the customer, or do they kind of steer you to a channel? I could put on my, I won't bother doing, but I could put on the, I could dial a phone number here for United Airlines, my frequent flyer card. You dial the number, it says, reservations, 1-800-225-800. The first thing it says is, type in your frequent flyer number so we can decide where to route your call. And if you are a flyer like me, you get the good fast line. If you're a low flyer, they give you the slow reservation line because they don't have to get the same quality service because people don't fly very often. I have demanding service quality expectations. They give me the quick, short line to talk to someone who says, what can I do for you, Dr. Blush? I see you flying again next week, you know, whatever it is. So they select, they have multiple different channels within their online channel for different customer segments, different classes of service. And again, how can customers assemble some set of channels to meet their particular best way of doing something? So that's what the kind of stuff which was in that story by the Portuguese people, Patricio, the banking study. She used to work in a bank for 10 years. I actually met her last week in Hawaii. And we talked about this paper. I redrew the picture so you could see it better because they're kind of hard without the color. This is what it says here. It says, we asked people on these three dimensions of usability, usefulness, personal contact, and efficiency, how they prefer these different channels. So you have internet banking, telephone banking, going to the branch, the physical banking, and the ATM banking. And it said, how do you rate these different channels on these three dimensions? Usefulness, personal contact, and efficiency. You see that internet banking, the red line, gets ranked pretty high on efficiency and on usefulness. There's not much personal contact there, so it gets lower than the other ones, than branch banking does. Telephone banking gets rated lower than internet banking on every dimension that they compare. So they say this gray line is inside of the blue line here, all right? Inside of the red line. The ATM is lower than banking because it doesn't have as much capability as the branch banking or the internet banking and so on. So you're seeing that there are different preferences for different channels for different on different dimensions. But of course, it depends on what you're doing. If you are checking your account details, then internet banking really wins. So this is the green box. So these are much higher numbers than going to the branch to ask the same questions. So it's much less satisfying to use the branch bank to talk about your account balance. That makes sense. You have to wait in line to say, what's my balance? That's pretty lame. Okay? Low satisfaction. On the other hand, if you want to get a mortgage application to get a loan, then it's really not very easy to do and get very much satisfaction out of the online version, whereas going to the branch is where you have to go. So you have this crossover where the channels are differentially valued for different service types. And this reminded me of this slide, which was Luba's favorite slide from about a month ago. Remember this slide? All right. This said that different kinds of websites need different kinds of design features. And not surprising, sites which are basically utilitarian will need more functional stuff than sites which are more experiential. And that's kind of the same kind of aspect going on here, where people need to interact with people to have certain kinds of information exchange and questions answered and so on that they can't get done in the online environment. So people have different preferences for channels. Question is, what caused them to choose one or the other? Is it a voluntary choice or is it an involuntary choice? Is it being nudged by the service provider or are they doing it under their own free will? And of course, we can do it all those ways. The provider can shape the customer's incentives. Like, we'll give you a $10 off if you go get the ticket online. Or we could do it with penalties, saying you pay $10 more per ticket if you call the customer service person directly, talk to a live person. Okay? And I think which people feel good about depends on whether they view it as fair. So you say, well, gee, it does cost you more to provide a person to talk to, so maybe it's okay to pay extra for that. I get more personalized service. I can answer more of my questions than going to the website. Or you could say, why should they charge me more to talk online? You should always do it that way. So your perception, again, because of the gap model, is based on expectation rather than sort of objective reality, will affect that way you feel about it. Now, some of you may remember a lecture I gave when I was in India that had these charts in it. Flashback to the 21st of September. This is the relationship between demand and capacity, four scenarios. Remember this slide? It says, there's four situations you can be in. You can have more capacity than you need to meet the demand. That's wasteful of resources, okay, because it's underutilized. You can have not enough capacity, which means you're going to alienate customers, they're going to go away because they're not getting served fast enough, or you can be somewhere in the middle. The optimal place is probably about here, where you can satisfy most customers pretty quickly because you have available capacity which can handle the average load, and with a little bit of load balancing and queuing, you can handle the peaks that come in probably at predictable times. But we talked a lot that lecture, at least I talked to myself that lecture a lot, about, actually Kate was in the room. There was one person that came to that lecture, that was Kate, because I recorded it before I left. Bless you, Kate. If you just change time period to channel, all the same rules apply. Because we talked then about mostly how you shift demand in time. We can shift it in channel the same way by saying we can have price discounts or surcharges. We can have essentially a less attractive service package on one or the other. So we'll see that in a minute, how you can get people to go away by giving them bad service in one channel, and maybe that's what you want. Okay? You can bundle to offer a combination of services and some maybe better deal if you use a channel. If you go online, we'll give you discount coupons for things you can then print out and take to the physical store later or something like that. We can give you various kinds of loyalty rewards for, you know, extra. If you reserve online, we'll give you more points, things like that. So United gives you more frequent flyer points if you make the reservation online, things like that. You may be reminded of this picture. This is this picture about Francis Fry saying, how do you handle these customer variation and demand? Now, the classic way to do that is to have more employees sitting around so that when more people come, you can still maintain your service. That is called classic accommodation, and it's very expensive. What you want to do is say, how can we have still good service, but in a cheaper way, can we push people over here? Which might mean push into an automated channel. So you still get a pretty good service quality without having to have lots of expensive people. So can we nudge people into the upper left-hand corner where they have a good experience without having to pay as much? What you don't want to do is end up here where you say, well, gee, I can handle more customers by having crappy service in the channel I force them into. You have to go online, and the service online is lame. People are not happy with that. You've reduced your cost, but you probably alienated your customers. So you want to get over here, not over here. And that is harder to do than you think. And many of you may have heard of a site called GetHuman.com. Anyone know what that site is? Anyone heard of GetHuman.com? Wonderful site. What GetHuman.com is, it's a crowdsourcing data collection site that says, isn't it lame when you try to call someone and you get lost on the telephone? You know, if you want this, do one. If you want this, do two. And there's like 87,000 choices, and they always go to Nowhereville. And you never get to a live person no matter what you do. So GetHuman.com says, let's give you the sequence of button presses that gives you a live person fastest. So you pick one of your favorite service providers, like, let's say you want to call Delta Airlines. It says, press zero at every prompt, ignoring messages, bang, 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 and you eventually get a person. Okay? Or press three and say agent every time you get the next prompt. So this is it. How to get to the people fastest. Live people. Alright? So who's your favorite people like? Let's see, PG&E. They're terrible. Oh, they're not alphabetical. Well, I guess we could search for them, but you get the idea. Pacific, PG, not working. All right, get the idea here. GetHuman.com tries to give these customer service shortcuts so you can get to live people with a minimum amount of wait time, and that's important. Okay? And what they did was they created a kind of checklist, kind of best practices in online customer support, and they rated companies based on how they did on that thing. So here you see the user rating in the corner here. Average, good, average, horrible. Facebook has horrible customer support, online support, and so on. And why am I not getting any service here? My computer has hung somehow. Yeah, I was talking trash about Firefox or something. Okay, here we go. Try this again. I'll restart. No. Recognize this place, Kate? That's my front yard. Okay, here we go. Open file. All right, so we're at GetHuman.com, and they say that most companies get failing grades at this. Here's my favorite example that I liked, found. This is about eBay, which gets a failing grade. So this person tries to call customer service at eBay. Just read this. Read this. It's a great, great post. Not exactly trying to get you to use the channel, but they're not. They don't want you to not talk to a person in any circumstances. So they have terrible. Yes. What? This is from last December, 11 months ago. Well, this is 11 months ago. Maybe they fixed it because this kind of stuff. This is from I gave this lecture last December, and this is 11 months old quote. I guess I should check my data. But this is 11 months ago. Another example which is good is the one that happened last week, which is contrasting Verizon and T-Mobile. So Verizon goes, we want to go green with our billing. So we want you to stop using the mail channel for getting your bills. We want to have you go online to pay your bill. We'll send you an email saying your bill's now available. Go pay it online. Okay? They said, we want to encourage the shift, so we'll give away a Toyota Prius to some random person who has signed up for this online billing service. T-Mobile says, we'd love to get rid of our paper bills too. We'll start charging people who want paper bills. And they said, we'll charge you $1.50 a month starting next month. So a bunch of lawyers who customers said, you know what? We believe this is a material change in the terms of contract unilaterally. It's a breach of contract. Class action lawsuit against T-Mobile threatened millions of dollars of damages, and T-Mobile backed down last week. Yes?
Couldn't they have just raised their costs and given a 3% discount to anybody? I mean, if they had just done it the opposite way.
They could have done it in a way which is more palatable to customers. They're basically ham-fisted in customer service channel management. It's just somebody just didn't think through this and they end up with a PR disaster. Look for T-Mobile. It's just all over the web. Blogged by a million people. T-Mobile, Julie, you know, whatever. Okay? So, carrots tend to work better than sticks if you want to do channel manipulation with your customers. Now, that's important because customers don't stay in one channel. Customers don't think about, am I going to be a mobile banking customer or am I going to be a physical bank? They want to go to whatever makes sense to them at the moment they're doing it. They have to be able to move fluidly between channels. And so there's this notion that I like called customer trajectories, which is, what is the trajectory or path through the multiple channels within and between channels? Now, of course, even things like Amazon, when you go to buy online, there's going to be an inherently physical part of that experience because things are going to have to show up. They're going to get shipped through UPS and so on. So there'll be a physical channel part of that experience. Okay? But for other kind of things, you may have a complete choice about whether you do it in the physical world or the virtual world. So I can go to the store and buy it, or I can go to the online store and buy it. I can search in one and buy in the other, or vice versa. You may say, I want to go search online and buy it in the physical store after I know what the features are. Or I can go look in the physical store to see what I want and then go buy it online at a cheaper price. So again, this sort of back and forth is pretty common. Implications of that said very different ways than two of the papers I had you read, by the Patricio et al., the Portugal banking paper, and then the architect paper, Huang paper, about designing spaces. Both were saying that you need to think more modularly about your processes and about the services you're offering, about the possible trajectory, so you have small pieces that can be connected in different ways. So they both were saying that, but in very different ways. And I'll see that in a minute. And Huang said that you need to think about your physical and virtual structures as being designed as part of an overall, overarching structure that contains these different trajectories. So you may remember this picture, which effectively says, do fine-grained process modeling, kind of like blueprint modeling of the experience. This is the one about, I want to go to perhaps that store, I do virtual clothes and things like that, the Huang paper. And you see the physical aspects, like scanning your body, has to take place on the physical channel. But then once you do that, you can then do things online. So you have this sort of the different sets of attracting customers, getting their needs, informing them, and so on, ordering, could take place in one or the other or both. And you can sort of see here possible trajectories going between the two sides. This is related to what you saw here in the banking paper. We have what they call the multi-channel blueprint. This shows the connection between the physical branch banking and the internet banking, where they want people to be able to use the most efficient channel, but they want to nudge them there rather than force them there. So we know from the survey that it's easier to check your balance online than to ask a bank teller about it. But maybe you don't know that. So you go to a bank employee here and say, what's my balance? They say, well, let me show you how to use the online service for that. Okay? So they make the offer here about, do you know how to use the online service? And if they don't, they train them to do it and try to nudge them in that channel. So this has a blueprint that shows multiple channels at the same time. It shows decision logic, which the classic blueprint didn't show last week about the Bittner paper. And it has this kind of like magic button. I don't know. I like this idea of a magic button. They call it the service interface link, which is this three thing over here, this little, what's this here? This says, you go to this part and you jump into the other blueprint, the other channel. So you connect the physical blueprint with the online blueprint by touching one of these little magic steps. And that's how they connect the online and the physical blueprints in their modeling methodology. It's nice because you can have separate blueprints that show that they actually interconnect with these little like magic trap doors or something, what do you want to call them? Kind of Alice in Wonderland step. You go through the hole and pop into the other channel. There's kind of an alternative blueprint that was in the Huang paper that I found pretty interesting. I didn't quite, follow the process as well, but this shows how you've got these the physical store and the virtual store and the different things you could do with each of them and the different technology which would make that possible. So you see this is kind of a blueprint of a different kind. I didn't like it as much, although I like the overall kind of thing of it somehow better as an overall map of the possible services here. But at the level of a service design of an individual one, I like this blueprint better. But they both kind of conveyed something about the overall set of offerings, and I think together they show something pretty nice. So it's another kind of blueprint. It's not clear whether it's better or worse, but it's certainly better for some things and worse for other things. Let's talk about some of the some of the more strategic questions that face the designers of service system, which is the relationship between channels from a business standpoint. As we talked earlier, when we talked a little bit about that idea of whether you were cannibalizing your business by going to another channel, whether you're undermining your business model, that's a basic question about whether if you add one, are you really getting more customers? You're simply shifting customers around and maybe, in fact, driving away some customers who are not comfortable with that other channel. That's a possibility. Especially if you have to invest a lot to get to that channel. If you have to invest in new technology or new kinds of operational capabilities, you know, is it worth it? And the I haven't seen a lot of really good work here about this, because an awful lot of people got involved in this kind of stuff because it was the thing to do, right? In 2000, everyone had to have a web store. And they didn't really think about, is this going to make sense for us? They just wanted to have an online presence somehow. I know that Sunny thought a lot about this in her business, where people were just throwing money and stuff and they weren't really sure what they were trying to get at sometimes. They didn't have a good sense of what the design goals were. They just started building things. Can you in fact design a channel knowing you're going to push certain customers to it? Maybe have customers segments that you hope to sort of nudge in certain directions. Maybe your most expensive customers are, say, the old people. Give them a special channel. You know, customer support for old people. Maybe that kind of thing, possibly. But of course, when you start having different channels, you have to ask the question, can we manage the experience and the information exchanges in such a way that people kind of get the same view of what's going on no matter which channel they go to? This is really, really hard, because of course you may not want to have the same offerings in every channel. Maybe price will be different in some channel, but then you have the problem of who's keeping track. So think about if you went into a physical store and you say, gee, I saw this same sofa online for $10 less. Would you expect the clerk to know that? Should the clerk in the physical store be knowledgeable of all the prices of all those things in the online store? You know, that could be a year. They could have maybe more inventory they don't even have in the physical store, right? The online store could be bigger in terms of offering. Should they have to know what's available in that store? Maybe there are different terms and conditions. Maybe there's a no return policy in the online store. Yeah.
I think if they're using the same brand name, people will assume that they should.
They will assume, but then that may not be right.
Yeah, assume that they're integrated.
Is the store manager going to train people? Say, you spend an hour today on the online store learning the price of the online store? How are they going to know? So it's kind of cross-channel stuff is a lot of challenge to a operations perspective. And the whole issue about how much integration is possible and desirable is one of the key questions in this area that I'm going to talk about for most of the rest of the time here. So again, people may want to use both channels, but what may seem simple to them may require massive investment by the provider. So to say, I want to go online and see what's available and then pick it up in the local store. Or I want to buy it online, if I don't like it, I'll take it back to return it to the local store. That assumes that they have connected order systems. They have connected inventory systems. And of course, if the online store has more inventory than the local store does, then they may not even carry the goods you want to return. What are they going to do with it? Put in a box, send it back to the warehouse? That's very expensive. They may not want to do that. So, you know, what's easy from the customer's perspective may be very hard from the store's perspective. But of course, if the store could have one sort of back end that runs all the channels, that'd be very efficient to say, let's all of us look at the same data about what's available, where it's available, prices, and so on. Essentially, you want to collect data from all the customers' transactions across all the channels and unify that in one place. Now, of course, customers may have different preferences in different channels. They may order different things in different channels. So it's going to be a complicated data management problem. But if you do it right, you can say, gee, I saw that you bought this online. You show up in the physical store, they'll just give you an add-on product in the physical store to kind of cross-sell you or upsell you when you walk into the physical store. That could happen as well. So again, it's integration is a good idea in principle, but it may be difficult to get to in practice. But of course, if we have good data integration, we can do personalization. Not just within a channel, but across channels. We could say, gee, we saw you do things in the online world. We could use it in your physical world to personalize your experience, and vice versa. And you remember we had some lectures about that stuff, which I'm just going to flash back to in the slides, about the problem that middlemen caused. Middlemen, of course, caused the lack of ability to personalize because they blocked the information exchange to the provider. So that's why automation is so important, because automation collects data in a very easy way. And so the extent of your automation is directly related to the extent of your personalization. But it may not work that way because of the inherent asymmetry between physical and virtual channels. And about things like privacy. So think about what I could learn from you if you were online. Almost everything. I can learn what you looked at, how long you looked at it. You know, I know your entire order history. I can know because I've kept good track of that. I can know what other sites you've gone to before you came to this site because of cookies and stuff. If you're in the physical store, I don't know those things. So I could potentially use my online information to do a lot of value added in the physical store, as well as in the online store. It's much harder to go the other direction. There's this sort of asymmetry involved because unless you identify yourself, I don't know squat about you in the physical store. And getting people to identify themselves is actually pretty hard. So see if it goes, you know, use loyalty card, but that's at the end of the transaction. That's not when you walk in the store. It'd be better if they knew when you walked in the store, they could give you promotions while you were in the store. So there are now some ideas about having your smart cart. Have you seen these?
Yeah, there's a paper done by some folks at the Accenture Technology.
Okay. How did it work?
It was basically you would walk in and log in some way on the cart. It was actually a field study.
You'd sign in with your loyalty card on the shopping cart.
Yeah, and it had like a shopping list of what you bought before, and then it would give you offers based on, you know, trying to entice you.
So you're pushing the cart around and it says, Bob, we know you like potato chips. Don't go past. You know you like those. You like those really nasty ones with the lime salt on them. Go back and get those damn potato chips. Don't deny yourself this small pleasure. Go back and get those. They'll be talking to you. Don't come to the dark side, Bob. You want more of those lime chips. All right? And don't forget the tequila on the way. All right. But of course, you don't normally identify yourself on the way into this, or only on the way out. So there's this kind of potential which is hard to realize, but that's because people may not want it realized. I mean, think about your expectations. If you walk into the store and they go, beep, and they go, because they read the RFID tag in your sweater that you bought at Nordstrom, and now you're in some other store, they know who you are because they share data. You go, they know who you are? How do they know who I am? We read your ID card in your pocket. That's kind of creepy, right? It could happen, but it's kind of creepy perhaps. And so you ask yourself, what should I expect about this cross-channel integration? Now, I get mad when I have to repeat myself, so I probably have low expectations about privacy. I go and I said, I filled out the form online. Don't you know, you know this stuff already. You know my shipping address. Well, we don't have access to it. So I said, well, then, you know, I storm out like a huffed-off person. I'm mad at them for not having that information. I know that I've given them online. But, you know, how long should synchronization take? If I go online and I go to the store, should it happen like instantaneously, or could it be a week later, a day later? How do the business systems of the store work? Is it batch update overnight, once a week, or in real time? I had this problem once where I was going to go to... Actually, I was going to go to India. That's what it was. Just recently, that's what it was. So I was sitting at home, so I should check in online because I don't want to be delayed in the airport. So I go to the United website, or whatever it was, and I start checking in online. I said, you know what? It says I have to bring my passport anyway, so I might as well just go to the counter. Okay? So I go to the airport, and I try to check in. They go, you've already checked in. I said, no, I haven't. But I'd gone to the site, and I hit the first button on the form. And that became checking in has already happened. And I had to then spend 10 minutes unraveling the check that didn't take place to get my boarding pass. Because that attempt to just do the first button on the form was enough to think that I'd checked into their business system someplace. So it was kind of a nuisance. So let me finish with this paper called Get the Right Mix of Bricks and Clicks. Those of you who are like MBA types would love this paper because it's really a nice paper about business strategy in this area. Got a kind of a nice, cool name. And the idea is that this is, most of what we've talked about, it's not just technology, but it's highly strategic information, highly strategic decision making. For example, we know that it'll be very difficult. I mean, how hard is it to go to multi-channel will depend on where you are, where you're starting from. So if you already have a very successful physical store, it'll be more difficult than if you have starting from scratch, because there'll be different incentives for people and so on and so on. So they have this framework that says, I can have the business of the online store can be completely integrated from both a technology and a business standpoint. We call that the in-house division. Or I can have a range of different business models with respect to that online store, that joint venture, partnership, or spin-off. So there's a pretty good range of like start our own company that does the online version versus a completely separate, completely integrated division of the existing company. And this is really a complex decision based on a lot of things. I'm just going to show you some of the factors that would be involved that you can then start thinking about. The first one has to do with the brand. Do you really want your brand to be an internet brand? Do you want to maintain a separate identity in the online and physical environment? You may want to have a different name for your company in an online environment because you think you're going to attract a different set of customers, perhaps. Maybe able to price differently, keep high price in the physical stores if your same company is using a different name online. So instead of having the problem your online stores undermine the physical store prices, maybe you can have two different names for the same company, one online and one physical store. And think of any examples of that? What do you think about that? Okay. It could be that you haven't got the right management in place to do a multi-channel store. You may have to have separate kind of companies or at least far apart organizations because you want to be able to have different evaluation criteria for people running it. This is really important at the beginning of the internet era because think back to like 1998 or 99, if you can imagine what it was like back then. Amazon comes online as the new internet bookstore. You're Barnes & Noble, the incumbent. You say, we should have an online store, but do we want to risk our company doing this? We want to be very cautious doing this. Kind of innovative dilemma issues. And which of our executives wants to go and run that? So if it fails, if you think it's going to be a risky thing, you don't want one of your best executives running because you don't want them to go down with the ship. Perhaps. Okay? On the other hand, one of your best executives may say, I can go take this company public and make a gazillion dollars by spinning it off of Barnes & Noble, the stodgy physical people. So there may be some different incentives about who gets to run this thing. And again, how does it fit your existing business model? And are people willing to go off and take that risk and stuff? That's an important issue here. Operations is important because, again, of course, we talked about this before. If you have different inventories online and in the physical world, you may have to have different supply chains and distribution chains. It's not as easy to do as an integrated operation than if it's, say, smaller intangible goods. Something which you didn't see in the readings because it's almost too new is something I'm calling the MySpace Second Life Facebook effect, which is that we're starting to see all this community building around service providers. And you're seeing people interact with each other in a way that adds value to each other, but the service provider may want to use that information to improve its services and better attract customers. But that begs the question of how you can do that, because if you're too intrusive with that, people abandon those kind of communities. You can't really force your customers to crowdsource and force them to kind of be a nice community. They have to kind of be encouraged, but it's hard to do in a very directed way. Any of you know a company called Lithium? Lithium? Lithium. Lithium. Okay. LITHIUM.com. Lithium basically is a company that happens to be, I think, in Emeryville. A privately held company, startup, 100 employees. They're building these applications, software packages for companies to adopt to help build that kind of community around their offerings. The CEO of this company just moved into the house next to mine in Berkeley. So I talked to him last night over the backyard fence, kind of. So I'm going to learn more about these guys. Maybe have them come over to Berkeley and give a talk or something. So how do you integrate content you can't control? How do you integrate input you can't control? That's the key question that's going to get in the way of some of this channel management. If people want to have these alternative ways of providing customer support, customers can support each other, but how do you control that in a way which maybe maintains your brand integrity and all that kind of other stuff? You start deleting people's messages on your blog because they're not helping your company, then people just abandon your company. They think you're trying to sort of rig the game and stuff. So I'm seeing a lot of that where people are saying, I posted a negative comment here and it disappeared, so these people are evil. Now, they might have learned from that comment, but they probably didn't want to have it hiding out there. I mean, out there in broad daylight forever. But deleting it kind of breaks the rules of the Web 2.0 game. So it's a very delicate kind of thing. And finally, there's a question that we really deal with about multi-channel, which is what I call the digital divide effect. I mean, is it right or fair to offer multiple classes of services, multiple channels? The new stuff, the best stuff, maybe on channels that not everyone can use. So if you have issues about digital divide in terms of computing accessibility or accessibility or things like that, is it right to provide services in channels that your customers can't really use effectively? And then there's a class of services that public entities provide that I think are very dangerous to provide online because the essential information for the service is often only available online, only available face-to-face. So if I were trying to give somebody unemployment benefits based on their disabilities, I wouldn't want to do it online. I want to have them show up in my office so I can tell whether, in fact, they are disabled, okay, things like that, because there's a huge amount of fraud right now, and the state can ill afford to let people sign up for benefits online for things like that. So it's kind of hard to move that channel online, I think. What do you think? You could also argue the opposite, saying it's too personal to reveal some information face-to-face. I'd rather do it in the anonymous online environment. It's an issue, right? Okay. Well, that's the end of today's lecture. Next Monday, we talk about another context, the multiple device context. These are all very short. Don't worry. And I'll try to cut them down some more even between now and next Wednesday or so. I'll send out some revised, maybe possibly shortened reading assignments. And with that,